The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast. Discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is a great way to stay on top of China news in a few minutes a day with a daily email newsletter, a mobile phone app, and at the website subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, my alma mater, Go Bears, and I am joined by Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing very well, Kaiser, very well indeed. Always a pleasure to be in the Bay Area.
Yes, it is, it is. You've been to Berkeley here before, haven't you?
I have, but the only real time I spent here was in 2001. I don't think it's really changed in a lot of ways.
Well, it hasn't changed since the 1960s, mainly. Well, I have a quick Berkeley story about how things never change here. We just walked by that bookstore, I pointed at, in that little alley between Channing and Durant called Revolution Books. It's moved locations. It was across the alley before when I was here, but it's still there, which is kind of astonishing. In 1989, my friend Drew, who you've met, he and I had just come back from Beijing after the events of June of 89, after Tiananmen and all that. And we went up to campus and went to Revolution Books. And we were there kind of just to see what their take was on what had just had happened. And there were all these posters in newspapers, their own newspapers. I can't remember what they were called, you know, ridiculous commie names. But their take apparently was that the student protests were in fact about bringing back Maoism, bringing back the Cultural Revolution, that it was about overthrowing the counter-revolutionary clique of Deng Xiaoping. So it was pretty funny. We were laughing about their whole rightist coup business. There was also a lot of pro Sendero Luminoso, Shining Path stuff, the Peruvian Maoists. And so I asked the guy, this guy who had been behind the counter there forever, I mean, he was a fixture of my whole undergraduate years there. I asked him, so do you guys also support the Khmer Rouge? And he goes, hang on. Barb, do we support the Khmer Rouge? It was so funny.
Okay. So today, let's get into the meat of the podcast. We're going to be talking about law and the party state in contemporary China. As anyone who's been paying attention to the news from China is surely aware, the legal profession, especially those lawyers inclined to involve themselves in the defense of dissidents and their ilk, those
picking fights and causing trouble indeed, like
picking
you.
Fights and causing troubles. These people have had it tough in China with many prominent rights lawyers and not so prominent rights lawyers prosecuted and handed harsh sentences.
So our guest today is someone with extensive knowledge and experience with the interplay between law and politics in China. Rachel Stern, after all, is an associate professor here at Cal, both in political science and in law at the Bolt Law School here. We're in their library right now recording. So in her work, she is focused in particular on social movements and environmental issues. And in a forthcoming paper that we're going to discuss a fair bit today, she examines how the Chinese bar exam reflects the changing political climate in China over the last decade. So, Rachel, welcome to Seneca, and thanks for making time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Welcome back to Berkeley.
Hey, thanks. And thanks for those delicious Vietnamese sandwiches. So I guess I'd like to start just by jumping in and talking about this forthcoming paper of yours that I just mentioned. It's in the Journal of Law and Society about political reliability in the legal profession, in which you do a real deep dive into the Chinese bar exam and the questions that are asked in that. So I guess the upshot is that since the mid-2000s, 2007, I guess is the year you point to, there was a noticeable uptick in the number of political or ideological questions that were actually in there. Yeah. So do you want to walk us through sort of the major findings of the paper?
And perhaps you could start with what the Chinese bar exam looked like prior to 2007, maybe provide a bit of background on the bar exam itself. Brief history of the Chinese bar exam, characteristically Chinese about. And also for those of us who may be a little ignorant of the American legal profession and terminology, what is a bar exam?
Sure. Let's see where to start.
We're just going to go have a drink.
Yeah, it's like 2 hours later, you're going to be sorry you asked that question. I'll try to keep it brief. So the Chinese bar is the test that all of China's legal professions have to take. So it's for lawyers, it's for judges, and it's for the people who end up in the as prosecutors working for the procuratorate. And it's a test that assures a baseline level of legal knowledge. So it was a big deal when it was first introduced, and the latest iteration came into being in 2001. And at that point, it was one of the key reforms that was supposed to raise the quality of the people working.
Prior to 2001, there was no bar?
There was
a very low bar.
It's actually kind of not a joke. There really was a low bar. Uh-huh. But there were different tests for these different professions in the 1990s. So the lawyers had their own test. The judges had their own tests. So there were different entry points. So by bringing them together, they unified these different tests and also very much tried to raise the bar as part of raising the quality of the people who are working in these legal institutions. So that's what the bar exam is. It happens every year in September. It's a two-day affair. And it's a big deal. It's not quite at the level of the Gaokao or the high school entrance exam, but you've got lots and lots of people studying for the test really pretty frenetically,
right?
Because it's the entry point into the legal profession.
So maybe you can talk about, Jeremy asked, what about how does it compare to the U.S. bar? I mean, is it modeled roughly on the American bar, or are there other countries that China looked at?
Yeah, China looked around. Mm-hmm. As they did with so many legal reforms,
sure,
around that time period, they looked around to look at other countries and what they were doing. So it's most closely modeled after Japan. They looked closer than the U.S. for inspiration. Some of the key differences with the U.S. in China, law is an undergraduate major. So you don't have to go to law school to take the bar.
Oh, right.
In the same way as you do in most American states. That's one of the key differences. And the biggest thing is that in China, They threw open the doors pretty wide. Anyone who's majored in anything can take the bar exam. So if you're a chemistry major, that's cool. If you're an English major, that's cool. And you get lots of people who study all the legal content on their own. And then this is their main entry into the legal profession, is what this kind of self-study.
I see. What's the format of it? Is it open-ended essays at all, or is it all sort of multiple choice?
Mostly multiple choice. There's, I think, 300 multiple choice questions and then 7 essay questions at the end.
Okay, so it's a combination of the two.
Yeah.
And how does that compare to the U.S.?
The U.S. is a... It's state by state. Here in California, we've also got a big multiple choice section. We've also got essay questions, and then we also have a kind of practical component where would-be lawyers are supposed to look at legal materials and actually write a brief. So they don't have that part in China. But the general format, I think, is pretty standard now around the world, this idea that you have multiple choice and then also essay.
Okay.
What about the sort of regional question? Why is it administered at a national level as opposed to province by province, more as it is here in the U.S. where it's state by state?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you really kind of get down to the fundamental difference between the two political systems.
Right.
And the U.S. is so decentralized. So much stuff is state by state. It's a federal system in the U.S. And China's has always been about centralization of power and trying to ensure some uniformity over this mm-hmm. vast and varied place. That's an idea that has a long history.
And I guess we started that multi-part question with, you know, what were the major findings of the paper?
So the big thing is there's this really obvious change in the bar exam.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a secret at the time. In 2007, this new topic was introduced, socialist rule of law, and this kind of new political valence that comes along with even that phrase was introduced into the bar exam. So I did some content analysis to look at how the bar became more political. We see this turning point where it does become more political. There's almost no political content on the bar between 2001 and 2007. And then the second period where roughly about 5% of the points on the exam are allocated to topics with a high political valence.
So only 5% though.
Yeah, exactly. And I find that really interesting.
Right, right, right.
So it's not a litmus test. It's not like if you get every single political question wrong, you fail the bar exam.
That's interesting. That's interesting. So what do you suppose the significance of it is? I mean, the timing specifically of this noticeable uptick in political questions. I mean, I think many people would associate the kind of hardening that we've seen all around, this kind of new emphasis on ideology, as something that, you know, happened when Xi Jinping came to power, you know, Document 9 and all of this business. But I've often thought maybe 2008 was more of the pivot year. It was 2008 or 2009 when you kind of started to see a new assertiveness on the part of the party, a new concern over, you know, the power of the public sphere and its the internet as kind of the home to that kind of rowdy and troublemaking bunch. So 2007, what was it about that moment?
Yeah, I think the 2006 is the year that there's a big socialist rule of law education campaign that's announced. So I think the first point is that you're absolutely right. The roots of the current ideological tightening go far further back than Xi Jinping.
Right.
And you can think about it as an intensification under Xi Jinping. In fact, we're poised, people like me who are way too into this stuff or very interested to see what this year's bar exam will look like, because there was an announcement last year that the percent of the test that's devoted to political topics is going to increase.
Surprise, surprise.
Exactly. So we're waiting to see if what's going to happen this year and then next year.
It's this week or something, right? Or next week?
Next week, I think. September 21st,
We're recording on the 13th today of September, in case you're wondering. So yeah, oh great. How soon afterward will they actually make the questions available online?
Should be really fast.
Yeah, that's
it's usually within a week.
Okay, great.
So if it's, I mean, it's a test, right? And I mean, I know I've had a lot of Chinese people say to me that, you know, they had politics classes at high school or university and it was just something you got through and you memorized it and then immediately forgot it. And it was just almost like a shibboleth, but, a formality. You had to get through this. Does this actually have an effect on the conduct of practicing lawyers? And perhaps, you know, excluding the people who set themselves up as dissidents and rights activists, but the regular lawyer, is this going to affect his or her behavior?
Well, that's what the paper is about. It's a hard question to answer. And definitely when I present the paper in China, I get a lot of skepticism. I'd say the dominant reaction is skepticism. Uh-huh. This is people say, this is such a small part of the exam. These are questions that are really easy to memorize and then to forget. But I think that historically, the Chinese Communist Party has taken a really deep position on this question. There's a long history of education, patriotic education efforts, and a really deep belief that what people say and how they express themselves in public is what matters.
Right.
And that has real implications for social control.
And what's your sense on that? Do you think that it does?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I absolutely think that. So that's what most of the paper is about, is the argument is that these types of political questions, even though they're a small part of the exam, the argument is that they're training legal professionals in the art of correct public behavior, the art of saying the right thing in public in exchange for points. I mean, it literally could not be a more direct thing. Say the right thing, get the points.
Right.
And it's an interesting bargain because it absolutely doesn't matter what people think privately. It actually just doesn't matter. You can have your own private thought, and that's a different thing.
I've been in this conversation a lot recently with my wife, who's, you know, new to this country, just new green card holder, and she's pointing out the obvious hypocrisy in a lot of public morality in America. She says, "Look, you know, of course there is still a lot of racism. There's still a lot of sexism. It's just, you know, what good does it do for you to just banish it from public discourse?" I said, well, it does a lot of good.
Yeah.
I mean, it actually, this is how political culture changes. I mean, it's, you know, when your children are not hearing this, it's often what you say and not what you do that, I mean, for all our belief that it's the other way around. I think that this is often the way that things change. Jeremy, do you agree?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, forcing a speech code on people, whether it's sort of American liberal, you know, what is affectionately known as political correctness, or whether it's Chinese Communist Party political correctness, the speech code does change the way you think and your behavior ultimately, I think.
For good or for bad, right?
Well, it can be for good and can be for bad. It depends on the speech code, I think.
Yeah. I really like that American analogy. I don't know why. I never thought about that before. But political correctness seems to me exactly the same. And I kind of come down on the same side of that, too. in favor of not saying the horrible, sexist, racist things in public, because it changes the environment.
Exactly. I completely agree. Yeah.
But when there's too much punishment for you know, overcoming the taboos, I start to get uncomfortable, you know, if you say the wrong thing. And
as long as it's not directed against me, I'm fine with it.
Well, yes. And then they came for the long-haired rock gods, podcasting rock gods. So the rate of people taking and then actually passing the bar exam jumped up appreciably from about 13% to about 20% in 2007.
Yep.
The year that you say the political questions were introduced.
Yep.
Why is that? And does it have something to do with the, you know, the introduction of the ideological questions? Yeah.
The most honest answer is we don't really know. So this internal policy setting the pass rate is one of the important policy questions.
But I mean, you have a graph in there that shows, I mean, these are marked jumps in pass rate.
They seem to be very deliberate. They are very deliberate. There's absolutely
no
doubt about that. And I'll tell you what I think is going on.
Okay, great.
I don't think it has to do with the politicization of the exam. I think it has to do with a decision to expand the number of lawyers in China.
I see.
Particularly so that there would be more lawyers in the Western part of the country.
Quality be damned, just quantity.
Yeah, I think there's a belief that there's a right number of lawyers for China. This is the legacy of the central planned economy. And for a long time now, I mean, throughout the whole reform era, lawyers have been concentrated in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, Shenzhen. Those four cities.
So since 2012, the pass rate, though, seems to have come quite far down.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think too many lawyers now. And...
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, without being privy to the exact content of what's being said behind closed doors as people set the pass rate, I think there's a kind of adjusting of the dial.
I don't like them lawyers.
What is the specific function then of the bar? You know, its gatekeeper function.
Yep. It's a gatekeeper function to make sure that the people who are involved in the profession have a baseline level of legal expertise.
So just so people get an idea of what, when we're talking about pass rates here, the pass rates for the bar, if you average the 50 American states, is what?
Like 2/3.
Yeah. So it's very, very high pass rates. So,
like, yeah. So we've got like almost the opposite system for China. We've got a system where relatively few people can take the bar because in most states, not in all states, but in most states, you have to have gone to law school.
Right.
But if you have gone to law school, most people pass it. And in China, they have a system where they've thrown open the doors wide open to anyone who, with a college degree, who wants to spend the time studying this stuff. So you've got a huge pool of aspirants and relatively few people pass it.
So we were just talking about how I think we both agree that the content of bar exams, and I suppose it's pretty intuitively obvious to me, it influences the way that law is then taught as people will teach to the test.
Yep.
Having an effect? Is it actually seeing this happen? And are you seeing this happen in law schools?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that I happen to have written about the bar exam for lots of reasons, including the fact that nobody had written about it in English before.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that the bar exam is really just the tip of the iceberg. The bigger phenomena is the growth of ideological classes in law schools, the increasing ideological emphasis on the one hand. And then the bar exam is an example of a standardized test with political content. There are so many examples of standardized tests with political content, such as the Gaokao is probably the most important. And then the test that people take to get into graduate school.
Are there other professional exams that we're talking about? Okay. And those are all, you see, I mean, I know this wasn't part scope of your
thing. Yeah, but. I thought about expanding, writing something else about that. So we've got a research assistant looking into it and it seems somewhat mixed, but a lot of
architects have to.
I mean, there's a huge number of professional licensing exams. There's exams for tour guides. There's exams for accountants. I mean, almost anything you want to do that's a white collar occupation has an exam.
Right.
And many of those exams have political content.
It's very interesting.
It might be obvious to some of our listeners, but I think it would be useful to get your perspective on this. What is it about courts and about the legal profession that poses such a dilemma to authoritarian states?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the core dilemmas for the Chinese Communist Party, which is, on the one hand, courts and law offer so many advantages for the Chinese leadership. Predictable, efficient dispute resolution. I think you can argue that's a core characteristic of what states should provide for their citizens. So that's really linked to having Chinese citizens be happy with the performance of the party. Contracts, having enforcement of contracts, really important for economic growth. mean, you can go on. There's a whole list of benefits to legal systems.
I can't remember whether it was in this paper, but I think you actually, in one of your papers, you suggested that it's a good place to actually start to think of courts in China as simply a mechanism of dispute resolution.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key things that they're doing. So all
and there are a lot of disputes in China, as anyone who's ever lived there knows very well.
And I mean, I think the logic is really simple. Better courts than protest. Better to have these disputes.
Or people fighting in the streets, right?
Right. That would be the other option. It would be mob violence. Yeah. So I think that's the logic. But on the other hand, courts are traditionally make authoritarian states really leery.
Nervous. Yeah.
And if you look comparatively and historically, in particular, the legal profession, both lawyers and judges have often spearheaded calls for political liberalization. And I think that the Chinese state is well aware of the history here.
Absolutely.
Around the world. So there are good reasons why they've been keeping a close eye on the rights protection lawyers and on the public interest lawyers and others.
So there's one area of law where I think the, let's call it conventional wisdom, says that they've been a little less heavy-handed in cracking down. That is another area that you've studied extensively, which is in environmental law. So maybe we can shift gears and talk a little bit about that area of your research. I think for a while, at least in the late aughts, I think your own work in this area pretty much confirms, at least in terms of numbers, there was a huge, huge surge in the number of environmental cases that were being brought before Chinese courts. Is there something that we're missing just by looking at sheer numbers, though?
What are we missing by looking at sheer numbers? Is the question of whether or not people actually win. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
What kinds of cases? I mean, from reading that paper of yours, the impression that I really got was that these are kind of small time cases, and they're not really going after the enormo
like
SOE.
Farmer Wang's field is polluted with something,
pig feces or something, and then it's not like SOEs. It's not like a gigantic copper molybdenum smelter or whatever that's getting.
Right. I think there's two parts to it. I mean, first of all, why has there been this kind of space around environmental law when there hasn't been space around other kinds of issue areas?
Let's start with that.
That's the easier of the two questions, I think. Pollution is a big problem. It's a problem for everyone in Chinese society. It's a problem that goes all the way up to the very top of society, political leaders, Jack Ma, everyone. Everyone has to live in Chinese cities and deal with these problems.
Right.
So if you're at the helm of this system, there is no way to a stable, prosperous future that does not involve addressing China's tremendous pollution problems. And I think the authorities have known that for.
So no matter who you are, you have to breathe Beijing's filthy air if you live in Beijing.
Absolutely. And your friends complain to you about it. And they talk about maybe going abroad or sending their kids abroad. And so I think that the leadership has been quite serious in some sense about addressing pollution problems for maybe 10 years. Although, of course, there's a lot of pressure to also keep up economic growth. So I think that's why you get the space around and the interest in using law as one of many tools to help solve environmental problems.
So they're generally pretty safe. I mean, if I'm even a pretty activist lawyer in the legal, I mean, in the environmental area, even if I'm sort of, using my pulpit to kind of gather the forces of the public sphere about me, I'm safer doing that than, say, if I am, defending persecuted Falun Gong practitioners.
Falun Gong is like the third rail. That's definitely not okay. Yeah. I mean, that was kind of what captured my imagination about environmental litigation in the first place, was it seemed like a really interesting space where there was some freedom for activism, but the messages were still mixed. I mean, environmental lawyers do not feel totally safe, I can promise you that. There's just... if you're in any kind of civil lawsuit that's involving lots of people, lots of very angry people, which is what litigation is, by and large, it's not a totally safe space. And then I became really interested in how lawyers and others navigate the boundaries of a space where the signals about what's allowable and what's acceptable are decidedly mixed.
And how has that changed in very recent years? I mean, Kaiser asked about the late aughts and the tremendous uptick of cases then. What about the last few years, the Xi Jinping years?
I mean, I know I'm a listener of your podcast and a fan of your podcast as well. So I know you've been talking to other guests about what you call the new truculence of the
Hey, the somebody used
Kaiser TM.
Kaiser TM. If it was, I'll cite it too.
Oh, awesome.
So I know you've been talking to others about that, and sure. I think that that's real. So I think that the boundaries of what's allowable have been shrinking. That there's still some room for activism, but some things that were maybe acceptable or people were experimenting with are now have sort of moved into that zone of being decidedly off limits. Foreign funding is a good example.
Right, right, right.
That's gotten steadily more sense. So Chinese groups accepting funding from even international funding.
Even in environmental areas. That's something I was curious about. So the new NGO law and all this, there's a tightening down in especially foreign funded NGOs. Is that reflected also in foreign funding of environmentally focused NGOs?
Yeah. I mean, I think foreign funding has become sensitive across the board. For environmental NGOs in particular, I always think about they're the people who are just doing environmental education, which is really important work that has never been politically sensitive.
Right.
And then there's the litigation part of it. And litigation has always been somewhat politically sensitive because it involves large groups of angry people.
I always found environmentalism to be an interesting area because of the, like you said, the sort of expanded space for activity in it. But, you know, isn't that just another area around which, another pole maybe around which oppositional politics can coalesce?
Yeah. And in fact, that's what happened in Eastern Europe.
Right. Exactly. I mean, you'd think that they, since they're learning so many lessons from that, I mean.
Well, I mean, isn't that the reason why things like Under the Dome, the film, was you know, kind of taken off the air on the internet?
Yeah. What's your take about Under the Dome?
I think the Chinese authorities are super hyper aware of this history. So I think environment, for all that there has been a little bit more space there, is an area that's also watched very closely. Because it can camouflage people with a wide range of agendas, some of which might be related to political liberalism or democracy.
What about lawyers who are working on environmental issues, say, for example, trying to bring a lawsuit against a large polluting state-owned enterprise? I mean, it's still got to be safer than somebody defending like Falun Gong practitioners
absolutely.
Or Uyghur terrorists or separatists or something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was starting to suggest, I see it as a spectrum. If you think about the spectrum of litigation from cases that are absolutely not tolerated, that would be Falun Gong, Tibet, the Third Rail, right. Taiwan. Those are the really obvious, to cases that are totally uncontroversial.
Anything from Xinjiang.
Yeah, right. That's on the forbidden side.
Yeah.
And you've got cases that are totally uncontroversial. And you can think about contract disputes. That would be something very commercial and, you know, not political at all. And what I think is so interesting about environment, and I put labor in this category too, is these are issues that are in the middle, where in some ways there's some modicum of state support for the underlying issue and for resolving the underlying issue, but there's some political sensitivity there too.
Maybe these are the real historical reasons. Real bellwethers and that to watch labor and to watch environmental activism are maybe, you know, the best ways to see where the winds are blowing and
yeah, I definitely think that they're a good place to look.
Okay. There's another paper that you co-authored some years ago, and it's something that about which Jeremy and I have not just talked a lot about, but, you know, experienced very much at first hand while living in Beijing. It's the old blurred boundary trick where you know, not knowing exactly where the lines are, whether you're talking about censorship or what have you, has had this sort of insidious effect of getting you to tread more carefully, to self-censor, to play it safe. Can you talk a little bit about that paper of yours?
Yeah, the paper is about uncertainty and self-censorship as control mechanisms in contemporary China. If you look at other kinds of authoritarian states where China sort of starts to stand out and look quite different from other places, weirdly, for all the coercion that there is in China, for all the people getting beat up and thrown in jail, it's actually not that big a part of the state's social control portfolio. They just don't have the capacity. It's such a big country with so many people to throw all the lawyers or all the journalists in jail. So it's actually a pretty targeted small section of the population. I'm not trying to
Oh, we get it. You're not defending.
I'm not defending the policy. I'm just pointing out in absolute terms, it's relatively small.
They don't have a thought police. They don't have a secret security person on every corner watching what you're doing. But if you get too big,
right,
you might go down and everybody else doesn't know where the might starts and the definitely will.
Exactly. And there, there have been other surveillance states in history that have had a far more extensive surveillance apparatus where citizens have been much more afraid to talk in public than is the case in China. In China, you actually have a lot, as you guys know, you can pretty much say whatever you want in a lot of settings.
Sure.
With friends, over dinner.
Even on the internet in some cases.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you never know who's going to come for you. I mean, is another aspect of it the fact that there are so many different state bodies that can do you over for one alleged crime or another? I mean, you know, for example, if you're publishing a website, which is where I, you know, found myself often facing this uncertainty issue of like not knowing what the rules were. You know, you had the police who could come and get you in trouble for the intern you had working who didn't have a work visa or some, you know, problem like that. But you could also have, at the time it was GAPP, the General Administration of Press and Publications, or SAFT, the State Administration of Radio and Film and Television, which was trying to get control of internet video when I was doing it. You know, you have the State Council Information Office, the party's propaganda organizations, all these different bodies which might take an interest in one field of activity. Does that play into the effectiveness of uncertainty as a censorship tool?
I think it plays into the effectiveness of uncertainty as a censorship tool. And I think it also helps explain the existence of uncertainty as a censorship tool. So all those different bodies that you mentioned, they have overlapping jurisdictions.
Right.
So sometimes the uncertainty comes from actually a lack of central coordination.
Right.
That any of these different organizations could take the lead. It's plausibly within their ambit, but they're not, don't necessarily have a centralized policy.
Without naming names, certain internet companies that I may have had some affiliation with in the past probably did actually take advantage of this, of the sort of the, let's call them the gaps between jurisdictional zones or the contested areas where you could actually do things because you knew that you could just sort of play your parents off against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't asked for permission, then all you have to do is say sorry and you can kind of get away with it. Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what I'm really interested in, though, is that how does this sort of gray space policy play out when somebody does take something like this to court, because, you know, we've seen cases of this before. It's like, okay, show me the law here that I have actually violated, that, you know, the reason why you have censored this particular post. And the Chinese party state has been really reluctant to do that. I'm curious about your take on that as like a policy tool.
How does it work when they try
to take it to courts? I
mean, I think the biggest problem is getting traditionally the biggest problem has been getting the case accepted by the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a place where, for all that there's ambiguity, that there's actually a person there who has to make a decision about whether or not the case enters the courts. So showing up literally at the case filing division and trying to get the paperwork accepted has been a huge obstacle for activist lawyers of all stripes.
So there's a concept that you brought up in that paper. You call it control parables.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What are control parables and how do they work?
I'd be happy to talk about it. And then I want to know if you and Jeremy ever heard any.
Sure.
Let's hear what they are. Here's what it is. So I became interested in this idea of, well, you've got all these people operating, in my particular case, lawyers operating in a gray space where you don't know what's allowed and what's not allowed. How do people figure it out? How do they make decisions about risk? And I was living in Beijing in 2007, and I noticed that I thought that storytelling was playing a really important function. So when somebody got in trouble and that story circulated through a community, as that story was retold, it was often retold in a way that the people who were involved in the conversation started trying to guess at what line had been crossed, at what the moral was or what the takeaway is. So, for example, there were a lot of public interest training programs happening in that time for lawyers. So I went to one, and the lawyer who organized it got into trouble. So for months afterwards, I would interact with people in this community of public interest lawyers, and the conversation would be, hey, I'm just going to use a pseudonym here. Hey, did you hear what happened to Lawyer Wong? She got into trouble for organizing that conference. I heard it was reported all the way up the chain because the people at that conference vilified the Chinese government. And so the very natural response to that is to say, wow, that's so weird. I was at that conference and it was exactly the same as 12 other conferences I went to in that time period. What did Lawyer Wong do differently that might have gotten her into trouble? And so very organically, you get this back and forth speculation about the lines that were crossed. Well, maybe it was because she accepted foreign funding. Maybe it was because she didn't do it under the protective umbrella, the Baohusan, yeah. University involvement. And pretty quickly, as those stories circulate, people start to, I've done this myself. I've participated in these conversations. You start to get more and more convinced by your own explanations that you made up in your own head.
Right.
And so it's only a tiny leap from that to then saying, I think it's better if we don't take any foreign funding. And so what starts off as a series of guesses become solidified into what I would call socially shared rules.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Oh, Jeremy, I know that we both encountered this phenomenon.
Well, when I used to run, forgive me about talking about this, but this subject brings a lot of my experiences running Dunhui. I mean, before 2009, when it wasn't blocked, we were a lot edgier than sort of Beijing or Shanghai-based expat magazines or a lot of the China-focused content in English that wasn't, a foreign newspaper. And I used to continually get asked why we weren't blocked. Mm-hmm. And my pat answer, my kind of boilerplate was, well, first of all, we're in English. And second of all, most of what we do is a translation or commentary on stuff that's already appeared in the Chinese language. And thus, as it were, is almost pre-censored. So we're not going to go over any lines that Chinese people haven't already gone over. Therefore, we should be fine. And then, of course, we were fine until the one day when we weren't. And we were blocked. And then the question became, why were you blocked?
And that's asked of every single time somebody gets blocked. I mean, immediately there's this discussion. I mean, sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes it's because, it corresponds with a sensitive date or that there was something that was so clearly a transgression, quote unquote, air quotes, transgression, that it's obvious. But then it's those other times when...
Right. Well, in my case, it was never obvious. I still don't know, why my website got blocked. So and that is very effective because anyone looking at that and thinking of doing a similar thing will be like, well, it could be because he wrote this or published that, or it could be because...
Right, and then those become rules that the people in your social circles obey moving forward.
Absolutely.
Jeremy, don't you get asked all the time why Seneca hasn't been blocked?
Yeah, that is a good question, but let's maybe edit that out. I don't want you to jinx us.
Jeremy, did you ever come to a conclusion?
No, I didn't.
Really?
My favorite theory for the last few years is that I was doing a consulting job at the time, and some of the things I was saying were annoying some people in the company I was working for, and that one of them just got the hell in and reported, found something objectionable and reported it, is the theory that I've kind of been, most convinced about for the last few years, because it just somehow makes sense. But, I don't know. And there's nobody you can ask. They don't have a...
Yeah, they don't have a 411
hotline
number.
Yeah, where I can say, hey, comrade, what's up?
Gotintrouble.com.
So, the lack of transparency introduces this tremendous uncertainty for anybody who is, actually doing something in media space. And I guess it's the same for law.
Jeremy, let's start a new company. It's called whywasiblocked.com. And we'll explain exactly what it was that your website did to get you blocked.
All right.
That'll be fun.
So this perhaps is an old question, but Rachel, could we talk about the conception of rule of law today in China under Xi Jinping? I mean, he came in very strong, a lot of propaganda about rule of law, much of it sarcastically dismissed by Western commentators as,
like you.
Like me, by rule by law. It's not actually law as one would understand it, say, in the United States. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is any progress that's been made towards the conception of law and the judiciary as an institution of constraint? Or is the separation of powers, one separation too much for the Communist Party of China?
I think Xi Jinping is trying to do something really radical. I take his rule of law rhetoric extremely seriously. So I come at it from maybe a slightly different perspective. But I think
my ears perk up. This is interesting. No, this is the first person we've heard. I'm anxious to hear what you have to say. Go.
I think he's trying to redefine the very term rule of law. So this to make it actually mean something else. And I see this with a lot of different terms in the Chinese legal space, that there's a term that sounds sort of similar to something as a concept in English. And I think that there is an active effort by the Chinese government to redefine what it means. So I think he's really serious about rule of law, but I think, as you say, that what he means by rule of law is not the what we think of when we think of rule of law here in America.
But is it as crude as, you know, I think Gu Kailai, I can't remember if she was quoted or if it was in the book she wrote. So this is Bo Xilai's wife,
yeah,
who is now rotting in jail for murdering the Englishman, Neil Haywood.
Yeah.
She's, I think it's in her book, she says of her time in America that the trouble with America is that even when you know the guy on trial for murder did it, you know, this rule of law kind of gets in your way. Whereas in China, if you know he did it, you just get on with it and issue the correct punishment. I mean, is that Xi Jinping's conception of
that
will come
back to bite you?
I think that my take on it is that it's about fair, efficient dispute resolution in the vast majority of cases. So I think that that's sincere. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a minority of highly politicized cases in which there might be party involvement. Because I think that there's a history of the Chinese Communist Party seeing law as a tool to get policy done. And that's a very different starting point for any kind of conception of rule of law than how we think about rule of law in the United States.
I mean, that's impossible for most Americans to accept as an idea of rule of law, right?
Absolutely.
The fact that you can't
Absolutely.
Use it to defend the individual against the state, even if it works in the majority of cases, goes against the American spirit, doesn't it?
Yeah, and let me put it a different way. To put it very simply, I don't think there's any interest in judicial independence insofar as judicial independence means independence from the party.
Right. And again, to just, we can bring up this idea, a notion that there's a spectrum here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that we shouldn't see it as binary. Either it is American style rule of law, or it's that thing that we just dismiss as rule by law. I mean, there is something in between. I mean, where a more robust judiciary doesn't need to become a truly effective institution of constraint, where, you know, to the point where it subjects any and all people, irrespective of their place in the political hierarchy, to that same law. I mean, it maybe doesn't attain to that, but it still improves, you know, quite conspicuously the ability to dispense justice and, you know, as what you
yeah.
said.
Yeah, everyday justice.
Right, everyday justice, right.
Everyday yeah. justice for most people.
So, I mean, do you think we've seen signs of that in effect? Like, is it, I mean, okay, so you can't take the Constitution at its word and have real freedom of speech, but Mr. Wang, with his field being polluted by not the biggest state-owned enterprise, but, you know, Mr. Zhou's cadmium factory, he has a chance in today's China.
Yeah.
Would that be an accurate statement?
I think in any country anywhere in the world, it's hard to win a legal case if you go up against economic elites in your hometown. So having said that, if you're taking on the big factory, whether it's Aaron Brockovich in the United States or, you know, Mr. Wang's giant SOE in China, I think that's a hard case to win. But when I look at the legal reforms, I read them as a sincere effort to try to make courts work better for ordinary people. So let me just give you one small example that I think didn't get as much play in the English press as it maybe should have. So I said that one of the key obstacles in environmental cases was getting the case into the court,
right?
Convincing the judges who literally sit at the desk in the case acceptance division to accept the case. And there was a major reform to try to give those judges a lot less discretion. Because what was happening was they were saying no to cases that looked like they were going to be politically sensitive and that were going to be a headache for the court. So under the new regulations that probably took effect maybe 18 months ago now, those judges are just supposed to accept everything that comes in the door.
Oh, wow.
Huge change.
Oh, my gosh.
Actually, empirically unclear how it's playing out on the ground.
But this is something you'll be looking at. And
something me and others me will be looking at.
And that you'll come on to talk to us about next
time.
Yeah,
absolutely. But yeah, I view that as a sincere effort to try to make the courts into the preferred forum for dispute resolution. Because again, better courts than protest.
Rachel Stern, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
Fascinating conversation, and we look forward to chatting with you again about this and about other things. So stick around with us so we can hear what you have to recommend to our listeners, yeah?
Great.
Before we get to recommendations, we want to remind our listeners that the Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SupChina on Twitter at SupChinaNews and on Facebook at facebook.com/SupChinaNews. Recommendations. Jeremy, why don't you kick us off?
All right. I don't think this has been recommended on the podcast before. It's a blog called Politics from the Provinces. So the URL is politicsfromtheprovinces.blogspot. And I have it bookmarked as .de. It might work on .com as well. It's written by somebody who appears to spend a lot of time in the provinces in China. And I think he self-describes it as, you know, politics from outside the beltway of Beijing and Shanghai. And he's quite a perspicacious observer of the Chinese scene and, you know, how things look a little different.
Do we know who he is?
I don't actually know who he is. I think it's a he. It may be a she.
She chooses to remain anonymous.
I think so, but well worth a read. Politics from the Provinces. And yeah, it is always good to get a voice who is in China, immersed in the Chinese life, but not in Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, where one can have a very distorted view of the People's Republic.
Really? Not at all. Like Chiang Chi is a perfect microcosm. Excellent. Politics from the provinces.blogspot.de. That's a long ass URL.
We'll put a link to it.
Yeah, we will. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you. Rachel, what do you have for us?
I'm a fan of documentary film. So I want to recommend a documentary film by a director named Zhou Hao. In English, it's called The Chinese Mayor.
Oh, yeah.
Did someone talk about it on this podcast?
We have, but no, you know, it's worth another recommendation. I think, Jeremy, I think you probably recommended
it. I think I recommended the New York Times had a kind of little short version of it.
They did put 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so I'm going to endorse the whole thing.
The whole thing, yes. Right. Excellent.
Because you can now see it on YouTube for $4. It's actually the first time I've rented anything on YouTube. But it's for those of you who didn't hear the earlier thing, it's the filmmaker followed around the mayor of Datong and had incredible access over like a 3-year period. It's a super interesting film. And for me, there's the interesting thing at the core of the film is the ambiguity over whether the mayor is a good official and is doing his best in a difficult system, or whether he himself is part of the problem and out for his own self-aggrandizement.
That's exactly right.
That's a description of everybody in China, isn't it?
I mean,
everybody in the world. Yeah.
Because he's kind of a jerk. I mean, and you know, he's foul-tempered and foul-mouthed. And I
kind of went back and forth watching the film.
But he gets stuff done, right? Tommy Carchetti
from The Wire.
Yeah, exactly. My local plug is it's also playing at the Pacific Film Archive here in Berkeley, if you're local.
Okay.
On September 30th, and the filmmaker will be there.
Alas, I think September 29th is the day that this runs, so get out there and watch it if you happen to catch this podcast the day that it runs and you are in the San Francisco Bay Area. Excellent recommendation, Rachel. Thank you. Mine is a kind of pre-recommendation for a new novel, which is out this fall by my favorite novelist, who is Michael Chabon. Who lives here in Berkeley, in fact. Do you know him?
Not personally, no.
Oh, man, I'm looking for somebody.
I follow his wife's Twitter account. That's as close as I get.
Yeah, yeah. She's an interesting person, too. She's a lawyer, right? No, wait.
She's a novelist, I think.
She has some sort of connection to the legal profession at some
point.
That
may well be true. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, the novel is called Moonglow, and most of the reviews that I've seen so far are really great. I don't know who gets to do these reviews, because he didn't send me a galley.
I want to just put in a warning message to our listeners. I once bought a book on Kaiser's pre-recommendation before it actually read the book, and it was terrible. So use your own...
What was that?
It was some terrible book set in Cape Town. It was truly horrible. I don't remember what it was, and I hope it's erased from my memory. But so just a war. I'm sure this author comes slightly better.
Hey, look, this is a guy who won a Pulitzer for The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
Okay, so this.
They say it's a return to form. Some people didn't like his one after Telegraph Avenue, but I loved it. Anyway, he's just, to me, he can do no wrong. Anyway.
Plus, it's a Bay Area themed recommendation.
Yes, it is a Bay Area themed recommendation. Yeah, and then also stop by and harass the people at Revolution Books because it's good fun. Rachel, thanks once again for making the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Jeremy, as always.
I just, hang on a second before we go, I'd just like to ask Kaiser, do we support the Khmer Rouge?
Barbara? The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Special thanks this week to Anla Cheng, to Amadeo Tumalulo, and to Sarai Darabi from SubChina. Thanks also to T.T. Liu from Stanford and to Jan Barris from the National Committee for U.S.-China Relations for so strongly recommending that we chat with Rachel, which turned out to be wonderful. So drop us an email at Seneca, not you guys, but everyone, drop us an email at Seneca@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/Seneca Podcast and follow us on Twitter at Seneca Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Rock and roll.